You are about to hear the opinions, suggestions, and observations of a licensed real estate broker in California. Since each situation can be unique, do not consider anything said here as legal advice for your specific needs. Always seek out the advice of a suitable professional in your area for advice tailored to your situation. Please remember that when following advice, your results may vary. Please also understand that the information provided here is not intended to cover all aspects of the subject material, but rather a sample of issues the speaker considers important.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubblegum.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Real Estate Realities with the Rebel Broker. My name's Robert Whitelaw, and I am the Rebel Broker. Somehow I'm getting the feeling that my volume is low here. Let me see if I can adjust that just to make sure we're doing well. Test 1, 2. Yeah, I feel low. Test 1, 2. I tested all of this before we got going and everything was fine. Let me try reconnecting, folks. We will restart here in just a second. All right. I think that should take care of it. I apologize for that. So the reason for that was logging in to do the show today. It told me I needed to change browsers, or that I should change browsers if I want the best audio quality. And it apparently screwed with my settings. And there you go. So welcome to another edition of Real Estate Realities with the Rebel Broker. My name is Robert Whitelaw, and I am the Rebel Broker. Licensed real estate broker in the state of California, member of the National Association of Realtors. But please, don't hold that against me. Here to give you all the latest inside, I don't know, scoop into real estate from an insider's perspective. I do appreciate you taking the time to tune in. If you'd like to get in contact with me, there's a variety of ways to do that here doing the show. You can call in at 877-503-5033. That's 877-503-5033. Or you can join the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/Rebel Broker. And when you go to the Rebel Broker page, you should be able to see a live show going right now, and you should see the chat room right there. Another way to get to it is to go to www.soldbyrobert.com or www.therebelbroker.com. There are links to the show at both pages. On the Sold by Robert site, if you just go up to the home section, the little home button at the top, click it, and a pull-down menu will come up, and you'll see the show there listed. So plenty of ways to reach out, whether you prefer to type in a question or observation or call in. I'm still concerned about my audio here. I want to make sure it's good. All right, so for those of you who've been checking out the show for a while, you know, well, or at least for a week, you know that last week was not the cheeriest show ever. We looked at a lot of different things. We talked about a lot of different things. And sadly, the way I usually like to wrap that up is here's how to deal with it. And, you know, I really came away from it with just general concern, but really no specific advice. It seemed like one of those things where we're sort of on a fence. So I thought this week, let's go ahead and talk about some of the folks out there that are saying that 2015 is going to be peachy keen. Everything's going to be fine and wonderful. And there's going to be rainbows, unicorns, and a coke and a smile for everyone who wants one. Obviously, it's not quite that fanciful. I joke. It's what I do. But there are absolutely some folks who are in this business in one aspect or another who are seeing things that indicate a lot of health. I'll be honest, from my position as an on-the-ground guy doing this stuff, I mean, I can't see what folks are doing internationally relating to all kinds of crazy stuff, right? So we're going to talk a little bit about why maybe we need to not worry quite so much about that. Maybe we need to worry just a little bit more about the local stuff. After all, real estate is local, right? But we'll talk about that. We'll talk about some of the current things that are going on and what some folks are saying, and realize that the truth is there's no real way. 2015 is going to be a transitional year. we've sort of come out of the ramp up, the post downturn ramp up that happened in late 2013 and 2014. And that stuff is sort of slowing down, and we're seeing sort of a transition into more historical type trends in various areas. But doesn't mean that there aren't some crazy things going on or people saying and doing some crazy things that seem to indicate an ignorance of what got us into trouble in the first place. But none of those things are at a level where we need to get horribly concerned. But we'll talk about those things and a bit more on today's show. So stay tuned. We'll probably save the majority of the main topic here of what's all the signs that are good for 2015 for the last half of the show. And we'll hit a few other things. You know, in all honesty, there are so many different things we could talk about. And I'm actually toying with, you know, we may actually need to shove in a second show sometime during the week. I don't know if the biggest problem for me is today. I have sort of a scheduling thing, so I'm not sure I can do the entire 2 hours. I may only be able to do 1 hour. I've actually got quite a few things scheduled up. But there's some interesting things. There's some interesting headlines, and we can rattle a few of those off towards the end of the show. But let's go ahead and jump in. One thing I thought was interesting was from the San Jose Mercury News. Bay Area rents higher than a year ago, despite recent drops in some counties. I thought there were two interesting points there. In some counties, rents have dropped, but in general, rents are higher. The article goes on to say, in a sign that an overheated rental market may be cooling down, apartments rents rose only slightly for the Bay Area during the past quarter and even dropped a bit in Santa Clara, San Mateo, and San Francisco counties, according to a report Thursday from market research firm Real Facts. Now, for those of you who are interested in becoming a landlord or you know, in any capacity, whether you have a single family residential home or you want to get multiple unit type investments going, or you just have an interest in what that market is doing, this kind of information is interesting. Let's go over sort of the numbers here, and we'll put into perspective why this rental information is kind of interesting. For the 9-county Bay Area, the average rent at a relatively large apartment complex hits $2,238 in the fourth quarter of 2014. That was an increase of just $4 from the previous quarter, but was up 11.3% from the fourth quarter of 2013. Now, the toughest market in the area continues to be San Francisco, where average rents hit $3,392. Man, for the average person in the United States to consider a rent of $3,392 has got to be mind-blowing. That is more than my mortgage by a nice big chunk. Now, the toughest market, as I said here, was San Francisco, where average rents had $3,392, down $8 from the previous quarter, but up 11% from the same quarter last year. Rents in Contra Costa County were the cheapest at $1,676, up $17 from the previous quarter and 10.6% from the last year. Some experts believe rental prices in the Bay Area have now reached a flattening out point, as they did at the end of 2013. Now, an interesting thing to note relating to this kind of data and the stuff I like to hear is how it relates to not apartment living. In my experience, when you start to see flattening or decreases in apartment rentals or rates, well, that means that they're having trouble attracting renters. Why is that the case? Well, typically, and in the way the economy is right now, it's probably not because someone's moving back in with mom or dad. It's probably because someone is moving out of that house and either moving into a townhome or single family residential home to rent, or they're buying a home. And that's the data I want. Unfortunately, they don't bother to kind of look at it that deep here. But it is signs like this that absolutely sort of kick my brain into analysis mode to figure out why this is the case. Now in San Francisco, which is a pretty crazy market, I mean, just the rates alone are crazy. But in San Francisco, that's kind of an interesting one. And this trickles down all the way down to Morgan Hill, where I'm seeing the same thing. Now, I don't have a lot of ins with folks who own large rental apartment buildings here in Morgan Hill. I occasionally get secondhand information from folks who I'm helping who are telling me what their rent currently is, or, you know, how rent has changed, or every once in a while I'll get information on vacancies and rentals for in apartment complexes. But typically if you start to see apartment rentals decreasing in monthly rent, if you start to see, and what I key off of is ads. So if I'm driving by a place here in Morgan Hill and I start to see banners saying, you know, immediate occupancy available, those types of things, well, those are clear. And you should be looking out for the same things, by the way, in your communities. If you're starting to see that sort of thing now in your communities, that should tell you something. That should tell you the demand has dropped for rentals. That should tell you there are people moving out of rentals. So the next question to ask yourself is, given the other things you know about your community, what does that mean for you as someone who may be a homeowner or a landlord? Well, if you're a homeowner, it may mean that there's more activity in your community relating to home sales. It can also mean that if you're a renter, it may be time to reevaluate what you're charging for rent. Now, at the same time that apartments are often decreasing in rent, you'll frequently find that single-family residential homes and even townhomes to a lesser degree are holding their value, or in some cases even able to increase a little bit. The desirability. Now, I imagine almost everyone listening has at some point lived in an apartment. You know, we all go through the natural progression. We start off at our parents' house, we get out of the house, and maybe we go to college, or maybe go to trade school, or maybe we jump right in and start working immediately. But whenever we do that, we're either moving into some sort of on-campus housing, or an apartment, or some other self-sustain, some sort of living situation that I'm responsible for, that I'm responsible for the rent. And then once that's over, typically we live in an apartment for some period of time, right? Or rent a house. Now, in my personal life, it's always been more desirable to live in a house. I might find roommates when it was in the early days of life. But eventually everyone wants to go to a house. It's just more convenient. It's a better living experience. And that tends to be the way the market flows. Apartments are the least desirable. It's a pain in the butt to have people living below you, above you, to the left of you, to the right of you, and behind you. It's just not fun. So when that situation is changing, when you're seeing those numbers moving in a direction that indicates there are fewer people doing that, the next question to ask is, well, if they're not, these people aren't just going into space and evaporating, where are they going? And that can often give you enough insights into the market for you to just make a smarter decision relating to whether or not you should sell, or whether or not you should invest, or whether or not you should buy. And yes, I've got my mocha this morning, but it's a very special mocha. I made it. I got one of those espresso machines for the kitchen. And it arrived Friday. I think I spent way more time than I should have on Saturday making mochas. And they're awesome. And it just means I don't have to go pay $4.25 for a mocha anymore. It means I was trying to do some math yesterday to figure out how many mochas I'd have to make for it to pay for the espresso machine I bought. And it was one of those decisions. I think I got one, a DeLong or something, for about $100. And I figured that's okay. You know, that's 30 mochas, right? Great. When I did the math for the other one, the next step up, you have to jump up to like $300. And that just didn't make sense to me. But anyway, so there's a quick Robert going into the weeds on his new espresso machine. And if you're seeing this kind of trend in your area, you might want to see what other trends are going on. Are you seeing more for sale signs or fewer for sale signs on homes? Let's see. And to give you the flip side of this story for the local area, the others say that this is far from the end of the skyrocketing rental increases. Asked if this could be the first hints of a plateau, Christopher Thornburg, founding partner of Los Angeles-based Beacon Economics, offered a four-word answer, and they were all no's. And I'm not going to say no, 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 and no, because that's just dumb. He's also one of the few economists who famously predicted the housing market crash. Long-term rents depend on income, which are rising quickly in the Bay Area, and supply, Thornburg argued. And the region is still desperately under supply. So while the numbers may show some slowing in rents, we're not approaching a plateau at all. But whichever way rents are headed right now, they remain staggeringly high, especially compared with a year ago, according to the study. Jeanne Story Wolf, a retired pastor who said she is pushing 60 and has had two strokes, received a 90-day notice on Thanksgiving from a new owner of her Union City apartment complex, warning that her rent would increase when her lease expired in March. The hike, $510 a month, from $1,550 to $2,050. The notice completely ruined the holiday season, adding that she depends on her daughter to pay the rent. Instead of putting up holiday decorations, baking cookies, and exchanging presents, we were looking at advertisements for jobs that would pay enough to cover the rent hike. A lot of stuff about it's a horrible burden. Every month is a struggle. They had stayed where they were because they were in New Landers. San Mateo had threatened to raise their monthly rent from $1,075 to $1,800. Let's see. Here's the average fourth quarter rent for several counties. Contra Costa, $1,676, up $17 from the previous quarter and up 10.6% from last year. Alameda, $2,002, up $8 from the previous quarter and up 12.8% from the last year. Santa Clara, $2,364. That's the county I live in. Down $5 from the previous quarter, but up 9.8% from the last year. San Mateo County, $2,572, down $8 from the previous quarter, but up 9.6% from last year. San Francisco, $3,392, down $8 from the previous quarter, but up 11% from last year. So, and despite the economist guy from LA whose answers were several no's in a string, the bottom line is with other news we're going to discuss today, if we truly are to believe that the single family residential marketplace and that home sales in general are in a recovery mode, then we will naturally see a decrease in the number of folks renting. Of course, that also depends on, you know, how many new people are entering the workforce, leaving college, kind of going out and doing their things in life. But we're building on a scale. We're developing on a scale that still accommodates that kind of growth and assumes for it. So the bottom line is that if we truly are seeing a more general healthy move in real estate, then a natural byproduct of that is going to be flattening of rents. Absolutely, the one point that he makes that I agree with there is that it really depends on the supply. If we don't have more people wanting to sell a house, then that's not such a good thing, and it may not work out as I say. However, that's something we're going to address later in today's show, where we've got some actual data to tell us where we can anticipate that number moving. Are we likely to see the same number of homes getting listed, fewer or more? And the data is very interesting. So we'll discuss that in a few minutes as well. But it all will kind of groove together when we finally get to the end of this stuff. Let's see. FHA loan versus conventional mortgage, which is better? There are several interesting things in this article. This comes to us from the Los Angeles Times. And the bottom line is that a conventional loan is better. I mean, I could burn a lot of your minutes all day. It isn't a question of which is better. It's a question of what can you swing? That's where we want to dwell, I think, because there's several things that I think are revealed by this article that have far less to do with whether or not you should choose an FHA loan or a conventional loan, and far more to do with the mindset that we're currently facing relating to lending. So let's see. Let's go ahead and hit some of the high points. I'm not going to read this whole thing to you. The Obama administration estimates that by lowering the FHA's annual mortgage insurance premiums by half a percentage point, remember we talked about this, I think it was either last week's show or the week before, as many as 250,000 new buyers will be able to purchase a house. That's the goal. A quote from them, that's great news and overdue. Does any of that sound familiar? It should. The fact that within such a short time of us getting ourselves into this mess, someone from the administration can say, we will create as many as 250,000 new buyers, and that's great news and overdue, is like saying that the Titanic 2 needs to sail closer to more icebergs. Right? This is the exact same stupidity that was coming out of the administration's mouth for decades before they got us into this mess, more specifically since 1995, right? We've talked about the roots of the problem. We've talked about subprime lending. That's what this is. It is the government artificially creating more buyers, which increased demand, which raised prices. We've been having this discussion since 2007. Almost the entire time I've done this show, we are now, we're now 8 years into this show. The vast majority of that show, we have over and over again explored what has caused the real estate problems that we've lived through. This is at the core. How does this end up being great news that's overdue? Well, how overdue is it? Do we need to go back to when we started to make it tougher to get an FHA loan because basically they had set the stage for the entire crash of the housing market? Is that how overdue it is? So is it 6 years overdue? Because that's exactly what we were doing prior to that. It's all very frustrating. The FHA almost priced itself out of the competition with giant investors Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac by raising its premiums several times in recent years. The FHA made itself too expensive and its market share has plunged, as it should. Fannie and Freddie and FHA are bad things. Now, I know it all makes us emotionally feel warm and fuzzy that we're contributing to someone's ability to buy a home, and that's great. But we have to remember specifically the folks that fall into this category. And we can discuss some of the things they cover. You know, and it's not like we're going out to unfairly punish someone who is at a lower income bracket. You can live in a lower income bracket and still manage to pay all the bills as long as you're taking on your bills responsibly. You can still have a high credit score based on the fact that you pay back your debts. You don't get a low credit score because you have, and this is something I just don't get. I mean, I've actually had people yell at me before. Oh, well, you just don't like poor people. What? I've been a poor person. It's idiotic. And it has nothing to do with it. The thing they were specifically attacking me for was that credit scores are just a way of labeling a poor person. Well, no. I know some folks with very low income who have amazing credit scores. You know why? Because they paid every debt they took on. They manage their income and their debt in a responsible way. That is what your credit score reveals. The credit score says nothing about your income. Your credit score says, when you take on a debt, do you repay it? When you bought that car, did you make your payments every month? Did you make them on time? Credit cards, do you pay your bill on time every month? It boggles my mind. It absolutely blows me away. Your credit score is, are you a responsible borrower? That's what that number is. And I'll tell you what, here's the flip side of that coin. Some of you may remember the show Worst Escrow Ever. Still Worst Escrow Ever, by the way. But the folks on the other side of that, not my clients, but the folks who were trying to buy, worst credit score I've ever seen, ever. They had a foreclosure. They had unpaid mortgages. They had all of this crazy stuff. But these were folks who were buying a million plus dollar house. These are folks who owned like $18 million worth of real estate. These are folks who made lots of money or would be considered high income people. And they had this ridiculous, I can't even remember. You know, and obviously your memory fades. I can't remember the last person that I talked to that had under like a 520 credit score. These folks were below that. So it's got nothing to do with your income. So when I'm saying these things, these aren't code words for the rich versus the poor. And the contention that that's what it is idiotic. It's bumper sticker thinking, right? It's, well, we need to attach some other kind of socioeconomic, political thing here because we want to, because wouldn't it be nice if? The truth of the matter is that these programs are aimed not – it's not even really aimed at poor people. It's aimed at bad credit risks. It's aimed at people who have conducted their lives in ways that communicate to the rest of us that you shouldn't loan them money. That's what it is. Now, it can absolutely come into income when it comes to folks borrowing way more house with more money than they should, given their income, which also happens here. Now, in my world, you're not doing anyone a favor by over-leveraging a homeowner. By saying, well, you know what? We're not going to pay attention to the income debt ratio for this because we really want you to have a house. So we're going to give you this rate. We're going to give you these little penalties to act as insurance. But we really want you to be able to buy a house, even though the mortgage amount will be a ridiculously high percentage of your income overall. All right. Well, that's asinine thinking. And you're not doing them any favors by burdening them with that kind of a debt. They simply have to buy more closely within what they can afford. Okay. This article goes on to say, now, who is best positioned to take advantage of the new, more consumer-friendly mortgage pricing? All right. Instead of saying consumer-friendly, let's say subprime-friendly mortgage pricing, because that's what it is. They go on to say, start with your FICO score. You've got a score of 620 to 719, and you have a down payment of 5% or less. The FHA is likely to become your first choice in terms of monthly payments. Why? No one else will loan you money. Because that's a crappy score. Well, no, 719 isn't a crappy score. In fact, you know, just about everyone I've worked with in the last few years who had a credit score in that rating, a credit score in that range, ended up getting conventional. So why they're, it's really the, I think the key part of that one is payment of 5% or less. If you've got a credit score there or almost anywhere and you're going, and you want to put less than 5% down, you're typically talking FHA. It will cost you less in principal, interest rate, mortgage insurance charges compared with what you'd pay for a conventional loan eligible for purchase by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac with the private mortgage insurance. Let's see. And then he gives an example, and we don't need that. Let's see. Yeah. So the bottom line is if you can get a conventional loan, you typically want to do it, but there are these borderline cases where that hinges more on your down payment, the 5%, for instance, where you need to figure out which is cheaper for you. So maybe it does help to read these examples here. I wasn't going to because the main point I was taking away from this was how we were really re-enabling subprime lending. But let's say you've got a slightly below average FICO score between 680 and 699. Before the premium reduction, your monthly payment using a 30-year FHA loan at current interest rates would have been $1,225. The same conventional loan with private mortgage insurance would have cost you $1,168 a month, $57 less than the FHA. After the premium reduction, the monthly payment on the FHA loan will drop to $1,138, $30 cheaper than the conventional alternative. So what they're basically doing is saying at what credit rating points and what debt points does this change represent a better deal for you? Now, here's what I find annoying is that somehow the logic here is that we should want more people borrowing from FHA and Fannie and Freddie. And Fannie and Freddie does not, these guys don't write loans. They buy loans in the secondary market. So your bank is writing your loan for FHA or to be sold to Fannie and Freddie. What if you've got a higher FICO score on the same 5% loan and rate term assumptions as above with a FICO score of 729 to 759, your monthly payment should be lower with a conventional loan. You'd pay $1,106 a month compared with $1,138, $32 more for an FHA insured mortgage with the reduced premiums. With a FICO score of 760 and above, the payment drops to $1,092, so FICOs matter. What other factors might influence you to opt for an FHA loan over a competing conventional mortgage or vice versa? There are several important issues to consider. And here's another, this is another thing I underlined here. The FHA is more flexible when it comes to underwriting and more subprime. Remember, we're talking about subprime. To debt, take debt to income ratios, conventional lenders using private mortgage insurance typically will not approve you if the ratio of a recurring monthly debt payments to your documented monthly gross income exceeds 45%. The FHA, by contrast, may stretch that if other aspects of your application, steady income, reasonable financial services, look strong. Some lenders say they can squeeze their FHA applicants through with debt ratios higher than 50%. One lender told me he's done 56%. Now, remember, this simply means that from a lending standpoint, they are creating a riskier mortgage. That person who has a mortgage that is 56% of their total income is far more vulnerable to any kind of a downshift in the economy, any kind of a flattening, anything that affects their amount of equity in the property or anything else that affects their life. Now, remember, the person on the hook for that is you. It's all taxpayer money. So, and you have to remember when all those crazy things were going in Congress where they basically passed a bill that put us on the hook for everything that FHA, Fannie, and Freddie would lose. Remember the series of bills where they first started with a couple of billion or 200 billion, whatever the billions were. They did several of them and they limited it. And finally, they gave up because so much negative press was being generated as they were taking on more and more potential debt. They finally passed one that said, with no limit, whatever the debt is, whatever the amount lost is, we'll cover it. Well, when they say we, they mean you and me. No senators, no congressmen are going to be writing any of these checks except through their tax dollars, but it's you. The FHA is more sympathetic in the way it treats one of the biggest obstacles facing many millennial applicants, student debt. According to Paul Skeens, president of Colonial Mortgage Group in Waldorf, Maryland, buyers whose student debts have deferred for 12 months or more won't have them factored into application, whereas conventional lenders include them. So we will ignore. See, now, what kind of sense does that make? It's not like that debt doesn't exist. It exists. It's money you're on the hook for and should absolutely be taken into account when someone is going to loan you money. It amazes me how cavalierly everyone treats the taxpayer dollars. Let's see. Some downsides to FHA loans. Top on the list, the FHA charges borrowers an upfront premium of 1.75% that typically gets tacked on to the principal they're borrowing, financed over the term of the loan. The FHA could have but did not lower that fee. Unlike private mortgage insurance, which by federal statute can be canceled once a borrower's equity reaches 20% of the home's value, FHA premiums on most loans continue for the life of the mortgage. That add-on to principal stays with you for years beyond the date you'd be able to cancel your private insurance payments, which in some scenarios can be as early as 4 to 5 years. Put another way, you will build equity in your home faster with a conventional mortgage compared with an FHA loan. And the big thing there is to remember that if you've got an FHA loan, that was originated as an FHA loan, or I'm not talking about loans that were later purchased by Fannie, Freddie, or any of these organizations. You know, you're not suddenly getting charged this percentage. You are paying whatever it was originated as. But if you're paying this 1.75%, once you've gotten enough equity to refinance and get into a conventional loan without mortgage insurance, so you need to have a 20% equity, refinancing is absolutely the way to go. If you're planning on staying in that home for the long term, holding on to it for the long term, that's what you want to do. You don't want to keep paying that that basic penalty. You're just not going to be building your equity as you should. Unfortunately, for a lot of these folks, that means that the market has to catch up with you. A lot of times it doesn't mean that just through your payments you're buying it down. Typically, you're not. You are a little bit, but the market change is really what's going to give you that equity. So unless you live in an area where market equities have really gone up recently, that's probably not the case. But if you've been servicing this loan for a longer period of time, it could be that you've bought it down far enough that you could get that more preferred conventional loan. All right. Mortgage rates, falling mortgage rates spur surge in loan applications. That's good news. More people buying is good news. Mortgage rate decline, which has defied forecasts, could continue. Our business is exploding. We can't write deals fast enough, Southon Mortgage Brokerage exec says. Given the weakness in global economies, mortgage rates are likely to stay low for the near future. That's all great news. Let's take a quick look at what interest rates are currently doing. Just since we're on the topic, and it's all really the same basic information. Everything's actually gone up, but they're still at ridiculously low rates. The 30-year fixed rate mortgage is at 3.63. That's nearest 52-week low. The 15-year fixed rate mortgage is at 3%, which is 0.02 above its 52-week low. FHA 30-year fixed is at 3.25, and that's unchanged, and that's at its 52-week lowest point right now. The jumbo 30-year fixed is at 3.6, which is right near its 5-year low. And the 5-1 adjustable rate mortgage is at 3.22, which is still at the higher end of the 52-week trend. The bottom line is all of these interest rates, except for the 5-1 adjustable rate mortgage, are their most recent increase is its increase from its lowest 52 weeks. So the change for the 30-year fixed rate mortgage was 0.03. Well, that raised it from 3.6, which is its 52-week low. So all of them were at their 52-week low last week, and now they're just 0.03 or 0.02 above. All of them, even the adjustable rate mortgage, went up the same amount. And the only one that didn't change at all was the 30-year fixed. So still money very cheap to get if you're in a borrowing mood. If it's something that you want to do, I think it's a good time to consider buying. Because remember the other part of the math equation we talked about. We spent a lot, and we're going to spend a little bit more time today talking about where we think the market's going to go. And one thing that we have to deal with is the fact that these, not only will prices go up, but eventually interest rates will go up. There's no choice. So now a question becomes, let's pretend that home prices do go down. Let's say that one of these global things that are floating around out in the ether actually come to fruition and negatively affect our economy and bring down property values. Well, given what would happen in those scenarios, because you might say to yourself, you know, I'll want to wait. What I would prefer to do then is, I really believe all of this international stuff is going to bite us. I'll go ahead and wait and I'll buy then. Well, yes, the price will be lower, but the only way that's going to make a difference for you is if you're paying all cash. Because if a huge bad thing happens, interest rates are going to go substantially up. So suddenly the amount of house you can afford goes down. And the question is, where is that tipping point where the price you're going to pay for the home and the interest rate you're going to pay for the money you're going to borrow for that home suddenly go to a point where if you'd bought now, you'd actually be paying less per month at a slightly higher amount, assuming prices went down, right? So once you kind of grok all of that, once you bounce that around in your brain a little bit, you suddenly realize that even if prices go down a pretty good chunk over the next year, let's pretend something to pretend that something bad does happen. Now, the last time we had bad things happen, we saw 30 to 50% reductions in home values. And the reason those numbers were so huge was because the epicenter, at the center of the crater of that economy, was lending, right? One of the huge things that contributed was the way we were lending money. So it was a real estate centered problem. And that's why values went down so much. What if something else happened? What if if something else went on relating to currencies or bank debt that is separate from specifically lending, home lending, those types of things? How much of a downturn would we see? I honestly don't think it's going to be I don't think it can be as bad as it was. And because a lot of these, when you look at a lot of these downturns and when you see big downturns in different markets, it tends to be a lot like an earthquake where there's after effects, but the after effects are typically, if you're graphing them, they tend to be a little bit less extreme. So given where we are, given the fact we haven't fully recovered in a lot of marketplaces in terms of regaining value of homes, I honestly think that the most we would see in most areas, I don't think it would be more than 10%, 10 to 15%, I think tops. I mean, as far as in my head thinking worst case scenario. So even in those cases with that kind of a drop, when I consider in my mind where interest rates could go, because remember, when I got into this business, we had interest rates 14, 15, 16%. I can remember stories from my grandfather who was in real estate talking about interest rates at 20%. So in my head, it's not impossible that interest rates can't just go absolutely nuts from where they are. So taking those two things in balance, I am not in a wait position. I think that we are seeing interest rates that 10 years from now, people will look back and go, it's amazing to me that interest rates were that low. And I think a lot of folks will regret not taking advantage of them. And I honestly don't want to be one of those. So I am in a buy mode. Me personally, I mean, I've been talking about this for a long time. I'm in a buy mode. I'm sort of putting things into place. I've talked about going out to Round Rock, Texas. I've also sort of diversified my consideration to places like Flagstaff, Arizona, in terms of areas that I wouldn't mind buying to have an income property. So In terms of when we discuss these things, if you would like to judge me based more on what I am actually doing in my own personal stuff versus what we talk about, I'm looking to buy. So I have several searches running on realtor.com in areas where I don't have MLS access, and I'm doing searches here in my local community, and I'm actively looking for properties. So, you know, and it's not the kind of searching that's just because I like to keep informed on what's going on with different properties. This is absolutely properties I'm interested in making a potential offer on. So if that gives you any kind of insight into how concerned you should be based on what we talked about, take it for what it's worth. All right. So let's, we already talked about the falling mortgage rates, so that's all good. Let's go ahead and transition here into talking a little bit more about 2015 and looking at it very focused. We're not going to talk about international stuff. We're not going to talk about global stuff. We're going to look just at the numbers we see locally here. We're going to consult with some folks who in the past I have seen be pretty, that aren't artificially optimistic, I guess you could say. There's a lot of folks who have a vested interest in saying good things about what's going to happen with the marketplace. Mr. Yun from the National Association of Realtors would be one of those guys. There are a number of folks who have a vested interest in the real estate market doing well. One of the guys I'm going to talk about here is one of those guys in terms of, you could see he has a vested interest in the real estate market doing fairly well. But in the past, he's been fairly well measured. I mean, and you know, both Zillow and Trulia, I think, are often well measured in their estimations of what's going on. And they tend to get more interesting data because they're dealing directly with folks who are looking to buy and sell. So their data is pretty good. We'll review some of the Trulia comments on where they think 2015 is going to go. But right now we're going to take a quick break and we will be back in a minute to discuss those points. So stay tuned.
If you haven't been listening to Real Estate Realities with the Rebel Broker, here's a little sample of what you missed. For those of you who are longtime listeners, you're probably not going to be surprised, if you assume I'm right on any of this stuff. You're not going to be surprised what bank this was. God, I wish I had a drum roll just ready for me to cue. Do I have anything like that? How about this? This might help. Run away! Run away! Yeah. Bank of America. Bank of America was the bank. One of the big boys, right? The big corporations that are supposed to be doing it better because they're so efficient and they have all the infrastructure. No, let me tell you what B of A is. And I guess for legal reasons I should preface this with, this is my opinion. The closest thing you can get to the DMV of the financial world, for my money today, is Bank of America. I'm sure that, you know, obviously this is the freshest scar on my real estate body. But I've been involved in real estate since 1988, over 20 years. And this would be in the top five worst experiences I've had with a lender. Simply because of just the totally preventable stupidity that we had to navigate through. And maybe that's unfair. You know what? I've never met these people in person. It was strictly an email relationship. But I got to tell you, when somebody asks me for the same damn document five times, come on, man. Really? Seriously? I'm trusting. I mean, imagine all the questions that then pop into your head. I'm making the biggest purchase of my freaking life. And you're the one I'm trusting? Mr. Magoo of the lending world who can't keep my paperwork and keep track of it for more than 10 minutes? I'm trusting you with my loan to get the numbers right? Holy crap. If there's one thing in your life, imagine this. Imagine you've got to have your liver removed. And to start off the operation, the guy starts cutting you on your leg. Oh, wait, whoa, whoa, whoa. Is that where my liver is? Oh, wait, yeah, I'm sorry. Whew. Look at the wrong piece of paperwork. I think I might stop the operation right there. Maybe it's second opinion time when the guy removing your liver starts by cutting open your leg. All that and more every Saturday at 9 a.m. Real Estate Realities with the Rebel Broker. Real estate. Totally unafraid. Find out everything you need to know at therebelbroker.com.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Well, we're going to jump right back into it here. And you know, during the break here, I was just thinking, totally not a real estate thing, but my kids are very much into computer games and console games and all that kind of wonderful stuff. And my youngest is into a game called Minecraft. I'm sure most folks have heard of it. It's kind of a build your own world kind of a thing. And so I happen to have an extra computer sitting around. So I set it up as a server for one of these things. I liked the idea of being able to peek in and see what the kids are doing. I think most parents like to be the house where all the kids come to play. So I kind of like that. I have my house set up to be the perfect kid lair. So I hope that when they choose to spend time with their friends, I'll invite the friends over here so I can kind of keep an eye on what's going on. I'm a little bit of a control freak. I get it. I'm sorry. I apologize. But this Minecraft thing appealed to me because I thought, you know, I can give them the IP address. I can have them give the IP address to their friends. And that way I can see what they're doing. If they're doing goofy stuff, and yes, believe it or not, in Minecraft, I have caught my sons doing some goofy things that are what young teenage boys apparently are preoccupied with. So that was interesting, which I won't get into. But in any event, the reason I bring it up is, I think as parents, my kids are my focus. When I get up in the morning, I'm thinking about how can I do it right? How can I prevent my kids from becoming idiots? How can I prevent them becoming asshats? You don't want to contribute to that, what seems bottomless well of stupidity that often contributes to angst in the universe. And a lot of that, I don't know, my kids are getting older. My kids are all teenagers now. My oldest is going to be driving in less than a month. In fact, in a few days, we could go off and get his learner's permit. So that's freaking me out as well. But one of the unexpected cool things that kind of came out of this was I set up this server. So then I went ahead and got Minecraft for myself, and I started playing with one of my sons, and we played on, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before, but we had some time to put aside. And I've got to tell you, it was a gas. I had a great time playing with my son on this server, coming up with creative ideas on how to build the ultimate castle. And, you know, he wanted to go off and do all this awesome stuff and discover new places and see if we couldn't, you know, it was great. So I'm sharing it because it was a special thing. It has nothing to do with real estate. It's more of a keeping life focused on the important things, I guess, kind of thing. But it was awesome for me to kind of feel like we're past that. We're spending time with dad is a fun thing for the kids. To kind of have one of my boys go, hey dad, let's get on Minecraft together. So that was awesome. And I'd love for other folks to have those same kind of experience. So to have my my 14-year-old son tell me, hey dad, let's play Minecraft together was kind of a kick. So, and I would love for other parents to be able to have that same kind of thing happen because that's the age, right? Right. That 14, 15, 16, particularly 16, once they're mobile, once they have their own ability to drive a vehicle away from you, there tends to be a lot of that. So, it was just very cool. And I was internally reminiscing and thought I'd share. All right. So let's talk a little bit about 2015, where a lot of folks think it's going. We will start with calculated risk. And the reason, and normally this is a place that does not get that. This is one reason why I picked this one first. We've got two that we typically go to, right? Calculated risk, which tends to be a little bit more measured. And it's a place that I really enjoy it because the guys who write here think their way through. The other one is Zero Hedge, which often goes a little bit nuts, but if you're good about really following up on the data they're using to see if you agree with their conclusions, it's their conclusions you might have trouble with. The data is usually really good. So I will oftentimes find a Zero Hedge article that I end up disagreeing with, but that prevented data to me that really helped inform something I shared with you down the road. So Zero Hedge is great. It's often not the place you want to go to get cheered up, but if you analytically and critically read what they're writing, you'll oftentimes, if you don't walk away agreeing with them, you'll at least have new data to help inform your overall conclusions. All right. So this one's called Update, Predicting the Next Recession. So you might think that this is not going to fit well with my whole everything's fine for 2015 assumption here. But no. Let's go ahead and just take a few excerpts here from this article from Bill McBride over at Calculated Risk. Forecasters generally have a terrible record at predicting recessions. There are many reasons for this poor performance. In 1987, economist Victor Czarnowitz wrote in The Record and Improvability of Economic Forecasting that there was too much reliance on trends, and he also noted that predictive failure was also due to forecasters' incentives. Czarnowitz wrote, predicting a general downturn is always unpopular, and predicting it prematurely ahead of others may prove quite costly to the forecaster and his customers. This next paragraph, this next sentence is really what I thought was a payoff, and it's something I've often kept in the back of my head as I read blogs about these things. Incentives motivate Wall Street economic forecasters to always be optimistic about the future, just like stock analysts. Of course, for the media and bloggers, there's an incentive to always be bearish because bad news drives traffic. Right? Now, that's something I've always considered with a lot of these different things that I read, particularly Zero Hedge. I can see how someone can get worked into a frenzy and really honestly believe a lot of these negative things, but there's always that little thing in the back of my mind that wonders, well, maybe they're trying to improve their click rate through some of these really, really out there estimates of what's going to happen. Now, this is a guy who's been pretty good about calling the business cycle. He argued no recession in 2005 and 2006. And at the beginning of 2006, he predicted the recession that started that year, and he made it just 1 month ahead of time. I'll be honest with you. That paragraph is a little self-serving for me simply because, remember, I started in January of 2007 doing this show. In January of 2007, my show was really more about just reporting numbers and news. By the time we got to August or September, I was predicting really bad things. So to say you got it by a month because you said it in November when officially it started in December, that's a little bit much. I think there were an awful lot of people before November saying pretty crazy, predicting bad things coming before December of 2007. So anyway, in 2009, he argued the economy had bottomed and we'd see sluggish growth, which was, depending on what market you were in, may have been true. Took a little bit longer in my marketplace, but not horrible. Okay. Over the last 18 months, a number of forecasters, mostly online, have argued a recession was imminent. I responded that I wasn't even on recession watch, primarily because I thought residential investment was bottoming. Let's see. There's a statement he makes in here. There's sort of a payoff. His thing is all about, and I can't find the specific quote now. Unfortunately, my highlighter for my web pages is not working this morning. But he uses the housing market. And I'm trying to find out where he usually says that. I'm not seeing it. But he thinks of it as the housing market as the thing that tells us when things are going to go good or bad, and I wouldn't consider that the first thing. I mean, I've talked about this on the show before. Now, if I'm completely disconnected from reality somehow, let me know. But for me, if the jobs market is weak, if people aren't getting jobs, I mean, if you really have a big, bad, horrible job situation, particularly low jobs, remember last week we talked about not only do we have too few jobs, but the jobs we do seem to get tend to be not career style jobs, but low income jobs. Those are not the kind of jobs that build home buyers, right? That was one of the points we made last week about why things might be interpreted as bad. So for me, there's things that come up prior to when the real estate market starts taking a hit that are indicators far before just the housing market. So let's go ahead and hit his main points here. The next recession will probably be caused by one of the following, from least likely to most likely. his first one kind of cracks me up. An exogenous event such as a pandemic, significant military conflict, disruption of energy supplies for any reason, a major natural disaster, a meteor strike, supervolcano, etc., and a number of other low probability reasons. All of these events are possible, but they are unpredictable and the probabilities are low that they will happen in the next few years or even decades. So meteor strike, yeah, I get. Supervolcano, okay. Major natural disaster, yeah, okay. Disruption of energy supplies for any reason? That was one of the things we talked about last week. Now, I guess we can talk about that because there's an awful lot of funky stuff going on related to that, whether it's Russia, whether we're talking about Venezuela, Russia, Saudi Arabia, or us. Exceptionally low cost for barrels of oil right now, which is really the most under pressure form of energy generation that we're talking about. I honestly think that because of the way things have panned out right now, we're likely to see fairly stable behavior from that for a long time. Him putting it in this category of totally unlikely, I think, is a little odd. But given what we currently have, right, we have a situation where we're probably going to end up building the Keystone Pipeline. We're going to do things that prepare us for times when oil is not $48 or $47 a barrel, but back up closer to $100 a barrel. And when you also take into consideration that in order for oil shale production, for all of these wonderful things we're doing to be cost effective, we, from what I've read, are one of the more efficient producers of this stuff. So in other words, for us to have a break-even point, we can survive with much lower cost per barrel of oil. So if it's around $80 a barrel, if it's $60, $70, $80 a barrel, it looks like we can survive that. I've seen estimates ranging from $40 a barrel to $70 a barrel of what it needs to be at for us to be making money, for American companies doing domestic production to make money. Every time I see estimates for other countries, I mean, Venezuela is ridiculous. Venezuela, it needs to be hundred and something. No matter what you do, it needs to be 100 and something. They're one of the most inefficient producers of oil. Saudi Arabia is not so great. Iran's not so great. Russia's not so great. So we're in a good position to be able to survive a lower number. Now, the reason I bring that up is I think that provides a level of stability. Because while we can go out and Google these numbers, you can bet that oil-producing countries are living and dying by these numbers. Right now, the big push is on to try and get us to simply not do it. That's why Saudi Arabia, that's why these countries are pushing these numbers way down, is they think they can outlast us. At least that's my take on it. But my feeling is because they are now calibrated to at what point we start pushing out more oil, they will eventually be under pressure to raise those numbers. And what they have to raise it to for their own survival is a number that is above what we need for more profit. So I actually think in the long term, we're in for some pretty good oil stability in terms of prices. Saudi Arabia, the Middle East is sitting on an awful lot that they can produce. We're sitting on an awful lot to produce. The question is at what point is it profitable? And I really don't think we're going to see crazy, crazy prices. I don't think we're going to see we may see weird fluctuation, but I don't think we're going to see a lot of crazy prices. I think that energy costs there are going to stay pretty stable. Then he brings up pandemics. Okay, yeah, the odds of a pandemic are low. However, the last time we had a major pandemic, right around 1900? Significant military conflict. Well, some of these tend to make the other, so we'll see how that goes. The next significant policy error. This is what he considers his number two most likely probable thing to really screw things up for real estate. This might involve premature or too rapid fiscal or monetary tightening like the U.S. in 1937 or the Eurozone in 2012. Two examples, not reaching a fiscal agreement and going off the fiscal cliff probably would have led to a recession, and Congress refusing to pay the bills would have been a policy error that would have taken the economy into recession. Both are off the table now, but there remains some risk of future policy errors. Note, usually the optimal path for reducing the deficit means avoiding a recession, since a recession pushes up the deficit as revenues decline and automatic spending, unemployment insurance, et cetera, increases. So usually one of the goals for fiscal policymakers is to avoid taking the economy into recession. Too much austerity too quickly is self-defeating. I'm not sure I completely agree with some of his side comments there about how the effects of austerity. You know, there are some pretty decent historical examples. For instance, 1920, when substantial decreases, and also right after World War II, where substantial decreases in what the government spent and what the government did reaped huge dividends. I mean, the Roaring Twenties were roaring because the government was cut by substantial numbers. The 1950s were amazing times for prosperity because the government shrunk by a big chunk and cut the amount of money he was spending. So I'm not sure his argument of too much austerity is self-defeating. Given resources, given manufacturing, given how the nature of the country in terms of a huge manufacturer of big stuff has declined, maybe that carries a little bit more weight. But I actually think this is a big one. Because these are policies that are actually intertwined with international policies that we talked a little bit about last week. So his number two one, I would say is probably are potentially fighting for number one. Now, his number one point has got me kind of scratching my head. Most of the post-World War II recessions were caused by the Fed tightening monetary policy to slow inflation. I think this is the most likely cause of the next recession. Usually when inflation starts to become a concern, the Fed tries to engineer a soft landing and frequently result as a recession. Since inflation is not an immediate concern, the Fed will probably stay accommodative for a few years. So for right now, I expect further growth for the next few years. All the austerity in 2013 concerns me, especially over the next couple of quarters as people adjust to higher payroll taxes. But I think we will avoid contraction. There's an update here where he avoided contraction in 2013. I think the most likely cause of the next recession will be Fed tightening to combat inflation sometime in the future in residential investment. Housing starts, new home sales will probably turn down well in advance of the recession. In other words, I expect the next recession to be a more normal economic downturn, and I don't expect a recession for a few years. And this he wrote this one on January 18th, 2015. So that's from today. A lot of interesting points. I don't agree with him 100% on everything, but I do believe that the highest probability for screwing us over is going to be something relating to the Fed. He seems to put a little bit more faith in the Fed than I do. I may be incorrect. He doesn't specifically address his opinions on the Fed, whether or not they're a good thing or a bad thing. But we'll have to see. A lot of interesting things are likely to come now that we've seen this change in Congress in terms of who's in charge in Congress, in the House of Representatives. So we'll see how that pans out. Unfortunately, the words versus the deeds don't seem to match up. You've got a lot of folks on who now are in control, who said a lot of things coming in, who aren't really acting on some of the things that they said they were going to make top priorities. Next, another one from Calculated Risk, which was linked from the other one, is The Future So Bright. I'm going to cover a little bit less in here and just suggest you go take a look at it yourself. This one's from January 18th of 2013, where he was kind of predicting where things were going to go. It's kind of an interesting look, and it shows that he was on the mark with a few things in terms of 2013. And let's see. So I've got two articles here. I think I'll go with that sort of cover the Trulia guy. And I'm going to spend a little bit more on the Trulia guy's discussion just because I think there's some good data here. And in terms of the consumer attitudes, I think Trulia is a good place to go. And we'll talk about some of these things here. Consumers think 2015 will be a better year than 2014, especially for selling a home. But the recovery will slow as the rebound effect fades before fundamentals become strong. Key markets to watch are the Northwest or Northeast, South, and West. So he makes a quick point here in the opening blurb of this article that I absolutely agree with. I think the recovery absolutely will slow. I think the recovery has slowed, and that the rebound effect is going to be fading until fundamentals become stronger, right? So instead of it being fundamentals are simply supply and demand, right? When you talk about the fundamentals of any marketplace, you're talking about supply and demand. These other things that are causing really artificial lows and really artificial highs tend to be these bizarre rebounding or recovery effects, those types of things, until you build to a point where those sort of fade away and you're just really looking at some of the supply and demand things. So I actually agree with him on that. Now, what does 2015 have in store for the housing market? 9 years after the housing bubble peaked and 3 years after home prices bottomed, the bottom and bust still cast a long shadow. None of the five measures we track in our housing barometer is back to normal yet, though three are getting close. The rebound effect drove the recovery after the bust, but now it is fading. Prices are no longer significantly undervalued and investor demand is falling. Ideally, strong economic and demographic fundamentals like job growth and household formation would take up the slack, but the virtuous cycle of gains in jobs and housing is relatively weak, and that will slow the recovery in 2015. All the same, consumers are optimistic, according to our survey of 2008 American adults conducted November 6th through 10th in 2014. All right. So that was sort of his intro salvo to this topic. And I think he's absolutely right. We've had some gains in jobs. We haven't had gains in the quality of jobs, which is a problem. And housing is relative, but he describes both of those things as weak. I agree. I'd categorize those things as weak. So where does that lead us moving into 2015? I think relatively flat, you know, and it's boring for me to keep coming on the show. I wish I had something a little bit more sexy to tell you, but I think flat is kind of the way we need to think. We talked a lot about how we had a lot of weird buildup in 2013. We had a lot of weird buildup in 2014. I honestly think that we're going to see a flat performance. You know, we talked about areas and some rents that were up between 2013 and 14 from the same time frames, and some areas where it was down, interestingly down in Santa Clara County. And for me, and you'll want to find out what the numbers are like in your area, but I absolutely think that that plays into a flatter marketplace in general. I haven't seen anything that, and this is early, we're only towards the end of January here, but I haven't seen anything yet that has me thinking huge jumps. I'm seeing jumps in the number of inquiries I get. I got a ton of leads over the last 3 or 4 days. Particularly Saturday, I got tons. And in one day, I got something like 15 leads from Trulia relating to folks looking for homes. So we're starting to see what I normally see towards the end of January, which is folks starting to think about buying a house. Now, one thing that I think is important to focus on is people tend to do things based on what they believe. So if we worry less about why they believe it and just go with what they believe, maybe we can form some good conclusions based on that. So let's talk about that a little bit. Nearly three quarters, 74% of respondents agreed that home ownership was part of achieving their personal American dream. The same level as in the 2013 survey and slightly above the levels of the three previous years. For young adults, the dream has revived. 78% of 18 to 34-year-olds answered yes to the American dream question, up from 73% in 2013 quarter four, and a low of 65% in 2011 quarter three. So more people in the 18 to 34 demographic see owning a home as part of the American dream. Okay, well, that's a substantial change from when we saw that in the downturn, right? We were down at 65% in 2011. We're seeing it more than 10% higher now. That's good for the marketplace in general. That puts more buyers potentially into the marketplace. 93% of young renters plan to buy a home someday. Now, that's just someday, so we don't know how long in the future, but it also tends to inform us maybe a little bit about what will affect rental rates in apartment complexes. And this is all despite rising home prices and worsening affordability. Which real estate activities do consumers think will improve the most in 2015? And this one's very interesting. All of them, but especially selling. Fully 36% said 2015 will be much better or a little better than 2014 for selling a home. When people believe that, they tend to do it. So that means more folks who might be in a position to sell are going to have more motivation to sell because they believe that 2015 is a good time to do it, that it's better than 2014. Let's see. Fully 36% said 2015 will be much or a little better than 2014 for selling a home. Just 16% said 2015 will be much or a little worse, a difference of 20 percentage points. The rest of the respondents said 2015 would be neither better nor worse or weren't sure. More consumers said 2015 will be better than 2014 for buying too, but the margin over those who said 2015 will be worse was not as wide. Yeah. So, I mean, that those are all good numbers that tell us that the general population has pretty good feelings about selling homes and buying homes in 2015. But there are some other things that they talk about that are barriers here. Despite this optimism, barriers remain to home ownership. Saving for a down payment is still the highest hurdle, as it was last year, followed by poor credit and qualifying for a mortgage. Not having a stable job has become considerably less of an obstacle, dropping to 24% this year compared with 36% last year. And again, for me, employment has always been the thing. With this huge drop in the number of people who in their own lives consider what the obstacles are to them buying a home, far fewer of them now say that their job is not an issue, right? Far fewer of them. In 2013, it was a full third more were saying that the job situation is something that was preventing them from buying. So that's great news. There's a lot of folks who aren't as worried about the stability of their job. Let's see. Different engines power each day of the housing recovery. During the early years, roughly 2012 to 2014, the rebound effect drove the recovery. Investors and other buyers scooped up undervalued homes and took advantage of foreclosures and short sales, boosting overall sales volumes. Local markets hit hardest in the housing bust, posted the largest price rebounds. Now, though, the rebound effect is fading. Price levels and price changes are both approaching normal. Foreclosure inventories are dwindling and investors are pulling back. This is inevitable as the market improves and therefore shifts to slower, more sustainable price increases and a healthier mix of home sales. So, and we've talked about this before as well. When you start to see the investors stepping back, that means they see less market value increase. So investors are saying, if I buy now, I'm no longer going to see enough of a rebound effect to make it worth my money. If someone was in a buy and hold or buy because I'm expecting to see a much larger increase in investment over the next year, those folks apparently have backed away from that. They don't anticipate huge growth in home values. So that just tells us that, again, it kind of reinforces that idea that we're going to see a little bit of a stagnation. We're not going to see double-digit increases in home values. That's what investors are looking for. They're looking for that home that over the course of a year is going to go up 10, 15%. Now, when they were buying foreclosure homes and short sale homes, and when that was easy to do, they were absolutely jumping in because prices were so low, and they believed that the market recovery would, the longer they hold it, just give them more and more money. And they're just not seeing that anymore. So we don't see them buying as much. So what replaces the rebound effect in the next stage of the housing recovery? The market increasingly depends on fundamentals such as job growth, rising incomes, and more household formation. These fundamental drivers of supply and demand haven't returned to full strength. They aren't able to fully take the reins from the rebound effect. Importantly, the share of young adults with jobs is still less than halfway back to normal. Many young adults are still living with their parents, and income growth is sluggish. This points to a tricky handoff. What does that translate? A tricky handoff? That translates into stagnation. That's what I'm predicting. That's really where I think things are going to be. So here's what they say to expect. Price gains slow, but affordability worsens. Affordability meaning and compared to what the average income is, right? Price gains slowed in 2014, and we'll see more of the same in 2015. Slowdown has been especially sharp in metros that have had a severe housing bust, followed by a big rebound. Now prices nationwide are just 3% undervalued relative to fundamentals. That leaves fewer bargains and scant room for prices to rise without becoming overvalued. What's more, with consumers expecting 2015 to be a better year to sell than 2014, more homes should come onto the market, cooling prices further. Nevertheless, despite slowing price gains, home buying affordability will worsen in 2015 for two reasons. First, even these smaller price increases will almost surely outpace income growth. In 2013, incomes rose just 1.8% year over year in nominal terms and a negligible 0.3% after adjusting for inflation. Second, the strengthening economy and the Fed's response should push up mortgage rates. So what are the two things? Real buying power in terms of inflation causing prices to go up of everything, but your income not keeping pace with inflation. Second, the amount it costs you to borrow that money, the mortgage rate, which we've already talked about. Absolutely things you need to keep in mind when you worry, even if you're someone who believes prices are going to go down, when you don't get those things into account, you potentially screw yourself where you think you're getting a better deal on a house, but you're not, because you don't get that better deal on the money that you buy with. And the money you do buy with may not be worth as much as it was when you were in a position earlier to buy because of inflation. The rental market will keep burning bright. Totally agree with this. I think rentals are going to be a relatively strong marketplace. I think single family residentials are going to be the brightest of all. He says next year we'll see strong rental demand and lots of new supply. The demand will come from young people leaving homes belonging to parents or roommates and renting their own places. Until now, they've been slow to leave the nest, but the 2014 job gains for 25 to 34-year-olds should lead to a rise in household formation we've been waiting years for. So his point is a lot of folks who have forestalled moving out will do so. I think that's a pretty good one. I don't think folks who own apartment complexes are going to be crying for too long. I think that this is a very logical conclusion to come to based on what we've seen in terms of folks delaying moving out of mom and dad's house. Single families, and a lot of this is also going to depend on how many apartments get built. There was a period of time there where we were overbuilding on apartment complexes, and some of those converted into condos, but I'm concerned that we may be overbuilding on apartments. Single family starts and new home sales could disappoint. While apartment construction is breaking records, single family housing starts and new home sales are still not much better than half of normal levels. They'll improve in 2015, but not as much as we'd like. Now, let's understand what normal levels are. Remember, we were catering to the artificial buyer creation marketplace from 1995 until the downturn. So if the quote unquote normal they're talking about is reflected in that decade, that's a bad thing. Given what we talked about earlier relating to policies where we're sort of re-embracing this subprime thing, maybe that's not such a horrible assumption to make, but I have to think at some point sanity is going to come back, and we aren't going to be pushing this crazy subprime lending thing. It doesn't look like we are. I mean, policies seem to be already moving in that direction, but I guess I hold out hope. If these predictions for 2015 sound familiar to our predictions for 2014, you're right. As the rebound effect fades and fundamentals take over, the recovery gets slower, and the market starts to look more similar from one year to the next. But there's good news here. Even though the recovery remains unfinished, the housing market is becoming more stable and more certain for buyers, sellers, and renters. Certainty is, we'll see. I'm not sure certainty is the word to use, but maybe it's more certain than it was. I honestly think that we'll see stagnation. I don't think that people need to worry about huge jumps or drops in any real estate markets pretty much nationally. Markets to watch. I thought this was kind of a cool one too. Number one was Boston, Massachusetts. Number two, let's see. Let's define what this is, because I think this is not necessarily good news. As the rebound affects, our 10 markets to watch have strong fundamentals for housing activity. These include solid job growth, which fuels housing demand, and a low vacancy rate, which spurs construction. We gave a few extra points to markets with a higher share of millennials. These young adults are getting back to work, and they will drive the household formation and rental demand. We didn't include markets where prices looked at least 5% overvalued in our latest Bubble Watch report. So after that filter, what we got was Boston, Massachusetts, that is number one. Dallas, Texas is number two. Fresno, California is number three. Middlesex County, Massachusetts is number four. Nashville, Tennessee is number five. New York, number six. Raleigh, North Carolina, number seven. Salt Lake City, Utah, number eight. Nine is San Diego, California. And 10 is Seattle, Washington. All right. So I think that's all, and I think that's a reasonable handoff. Maybe it's not so much we need to, if we focus just on local stuff, even local by saying the U.S., just don't focus on the external things. We see some things that are concerning relating to what might happen down the road by more than a year. But if we're really just focusing on 2015, I think what we're going to do is a year from now, we'll be looking back going, well, not a lot happened there. I think things will remain relatively flat. I don't think people are going to finish off 2015 celebrating how, if they bought a house in January of 2015, I don't think that they're going to be celebrating the appreciation they got in January of 2016. I think it'll be relatively flat. So I guess we can just sort of, however, I think the important thing here, and I've been saying this for a while, so I honestly thought we would see interest rates raised already. And the thing that is really affecting that is what the Fed does, right? So I took the Fed at their word a year ago and a little bit more than a year ago that they were actually going to raise interest rates. And they tried to do it a little bit and then freaked out because the market took a huge dump when they did it. So they didn't follow through on what they said they were going to do. So my biggest sin was trusting that a bureaucrat at the Fed would do what they said they were going to do, which required a little bit of strength to do. So we'll have to see. I don't think we can take the Fed's word really about anything that they say they're going to do or not do. But eventually interest rates will go up. They have to go up. There's no choice. The one silver lining in a lot of this bigger economic stuff is that we are the least stupid kid on the block when it comes to the countries of the world and how they're managing their economies. There's not quite as much talk about not using the dollar as the de facto currency for international trade. Too many other guys are doing really goofy crap with their currencies. Can you remember the conversations we had a little over a year ago about how Russia wanted to trade in rubles and people wanted to trade each other with their own currencies? And now the ruble is not, people aren't even, it's not even worth it to paper your bathroom in rubles. So nobody's talking like that anymore. But it'll be interesting to see how that stuff evolves over 2015. I honestly think if you're looking for a roller coaster ride, you need to go geopolitical in a lot of these things. So see how that pans out. All right, folks, that's about it. We were able to do a halfway decent show on this particular subject. I appreciate you taking the time to what I have to say on these subjects. If you'd like to get in contact with me, there's a variety of ways to do that. You can head on over to www.soldbyrobert.com or www.therebelbroker.com. I hope it was as useful for you to hear me say these things as it was for me to say them out loud. If you're interested in buying, selling, investing in real estate anywhere in the Silicon Valley area, please feel free to get in touch with me. Happy to set you up with a search or to set you up with an estimation of the value of your home to help you reach your real estate goals. Thanks again, folks. We'll talk to you all next time.